Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Fred Wiseman shot his film City Hall in Boston toward the end of 2018. Before COVID, before the police murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, before the vote that elected Joe Biden president, it was 10 weeks in the shooting inside the nooks and crannies of city services.
Boston 301, how may I help you?
So that's furniture and furniture. You can just throw that out with the regular trash.
I'm going to open up a case for Parks, the Parks Department. They deal with trees.
Then it was 10 months in the alchemy of editing and shaping what the legendary Wiseman eye had seen. It is now a 4.5-hour movie between limited release in theaters and national exposure on public television. And already it is a field day for reviewers far and wide. It's an artist's impression of local politics and public conversation that seem to have turned upside down and are not settled yet. To my eye and ear, Fred Wiseman's City Hall feels like a classic that dates itself before the flood, so to speak, but is not at all frozen in time. We're in conversation with Fred Wiseman this hour. He's in Paris, where he distilled hundreds of hours of film into a movie. Fred, what a relief to be looking close up at street corners, people fighting their parking tickets, City Hall wedding, all kinds of close political life, instead of looking at Trump and Congress, I must say.
I felt the same way. My idea was that a City Hall would make a nice addition to my institutional series. And because of Trump's idiocies, he becomes a silent character in the film, because it's inevitable that the viewer, I initially, and then the viewer makes the contrast between Mayor Walsh and Trump. Mayor Walsh represents everything that Trump isn't. He believes the proper function of government is to help people. Yeah. And he does the best he can to achieve that.
I took it also as just a love letter to cities in general, Fred, a sort of density, variety, incredible contrast. It's a rich city. And 1/6 of the population has hunger issues. But people are working at stuff. They love meetings. They love their neighborhoods.
The work of the people at City Hall is a reflection of a sense of community, which is often contentious and maybe always doesn't work. But it suggests a lot of people making a serious effort to live together.
Yeah. At times I felt the feeling was sort of autumnal. And then I thought, maybe it's me and Fred that are autumnal.
I can't speak for you, but I'm definitely autumnal. I'm going to be 91 in January.
My word. And yet, the other interesting thing is the young vitality. We don't see many schools, but we see all sorts of new immigrants, especially of the Latinx variety. They're busy, they're aspiring, they're hardworking, they believe in their streets. There's so much feeling in so many of these shots, Fred, even when nobody's talking. I watched over and over that scene of the trash truck compacting mattresses, desks, almost kitchen sinks in Charlestown. Unbelievable. Who thought of that?
Well, I did. The literal aspect of it is I wanted to show the city is responsible for garbage collection.
Yeah.
It was shot and edited in such a way that you sort of got into the rhythm of work of the garbage collectors. I've forgotten how many shots there are in the sequence. There are probably 20, 25 shots. Hmm. I tried to cut it corresponds with the rhythm of the work, the lifting, the dumping, the pressing of the button on the side of the truck moving down the street, the grinding, the teeth, the grinder chewing up the mattresses and the grill. It's both meant to show their work and to suggest the kind of things that people throw out and to be visually interesting.
Which it is. And then about 4 hours later, you come to the pruning of old trees on Boston Common, and you've got a wood chipper there, and it's doing the same thing. The maw of that beast is just as merciless and noisy. The wood chipper is telling you about kind of resilience, recovery, regeneration, death, life, noise. What did you feel at the end of it?
Well, all of the above. During the shooting, it's very instinctive and you have to act very quickly because you only have one chance to get it. But during the editing, I can look at a sequence as much as I want. I have to respond to the internal question of why. I have to delude myself into thinking that I understand what's going on in order to make the decision that I want to use the sequence and then how I want to cut it and then where I want to place it in the structure of the film. So the editing is a much more self-conscious process,
right,
where I have time to think about the kinds of issues you just described.
Are you calculating the feeling effect?
Calculating is too precise a word. I'm aware of the need to create a feeling in the way that I edit the material that I can identify to myself with the hope that the way I put the material together will convey that feeling to someone else.
The contrasts in this film are incredible. I mean, Brookings had Boston as the most unequal city in the country, at the same time, the lowest unemployment rate in the country. Inequality to the degree that the median net wealth of black people in Boston is $8. It's a couple of $100,000 plus for white people. It's also young, aspiring entrepreneurs and others, but also it's a city of elders, elders on the edge, and you treat them beautifully. They can't afford their prescriptions. Some of them are on guard against scammers who want them to surrender their houses, this kind of thing. And Marty Walsh understands the problem.
He's a very empathetic man. I mean, you know, he's had issues in his own life, which he talks about in the film, and he
at length
doesn't hide the fact that he's a recovering alcoholic. And when it's appropriate, he talks about the fact that he had cancer as a seven-year-old.
Yeah, I didn't know.
And he uses those stories to help other people. Particularly, he used the story of his recovery from alcoholism when he talks to a group of veterans, some of whom have opioid problems.
Right.
He's quite open. And I was very impressed with his kindness, his intelligence, and his directness.
I'm in recovery. I grew up in Dorchester, and I went to work construction, and you didn't tell your feelings back then when you're drinking and things like that. And my drinking got out of control so much that I ended up in detox. Whether you're in the battlefield and you come home, or you're in the bar room and you're not talking about it. And I connect the not the same way, because it's very different, but inside it's all the same. It's that feeling, that hopeless, what I had, hopeless, helpless, don't know what to do about it feeling.
But what about those people in needs that are not going to be fulfilled? For their prescriptions, for example, or their fears for their children. Scammers who call them up and say, we've got your son, do what we tell you to do.
He tries to address some of those questions. There's also a special service that he's established for older citizens, people over 60.
Right.
He says in that sequence in the church in Roxbury, well, you know, you got to use the service more. You're not calling it enough. Right. It's there for you.
Don't give any information out over the phone.
No.
If somebody says it's your doctor, send me a letter. If somebody says you're going to shut your cable off tomorrow, send me a letter. If they say you owe money, send a constable.
Speak more about Marty. Child of Irish immigrants, got cancer as a child, alcohol out of school, but he got lucky in recovery, also in politics. He makes recovery the theme of the city, recovery and resilience, and also the whole therapy of telling your story.
Right. But my bullshit meter didn't ring. He's not phony. He genuinely believes what he's saying, and his interest in helping other people is sincere.
And yet he's stuck with problems that mysteriously don't go away, especially the inequality one.
That's a problem that hasn't gone away since Homo sapiens replaced Cro-Magnon man.
Yeah.
And it was around for Cro-Magnon man as well. The notion that it's going to go away is a fantasy. The idea that it can be ameliorated isn't.
Yeah, there's no denial on his part. He says straight out, the racial disparities are real. The disconnection is deep in the country and the city.
Right.
Racial disparities are our deepest form of disconnection that we have in this country. And we realize in Boston, I realize in Boston, we can't solve the problems of the United States of America here. What we can do is work on the issues that we're dealing with here in Boston, and hopefully that other cities will see what we're doing and mistakes we might make. They won't have to make those mistakes.
He seems to be looking as if even Boston could set an example for solving something.
When he says that, I think what comes across is a man that is interested in process, and whether Boston comes up with the ultimate solution and the problem goes away is the idealistic part of it. But the practical part of it is that there are measures, steps that can be taken, policies that can be implemented that will make people better off than they presently are. And he's interested in that. He was too practical to be interested in utopian solutions.
Okay. The scenes I missed were in the schools. And there are people who feel he hasn't done anything like enough about jacking up school performance.
What you see in the movie is what I found as a result of 10 weeks of shooting and 10 months of editing.
What did you say to yourself you were setting out to do in this one?
What I said to myself is what I always say to myself is, I think a city hall might be a good subject for documentary film, and I'll roll the dice and try it. Because starting off in this film was no different than any of the others. I mean, most of the time, I don't know anything about the subject when I start. And I suppose there are those that feel I don't know anything about it when I finish.
Oh, no.
But I feel that in spending a year making the film, or close to a year making the film, that I've learned something. And that's what you see in the film. But when I made a film at a welfare center in 1973, I knew nothing about welfare. I had never been in a welfare center before. And with the exception of Chitticut Follies, it's been true of all the films that I've made. And Chitticut Follies was different because I had taken students there on field trips, so I'd visited it four or five times. But whether it's welfare or a juvenile court or the Paris Opera Ballet or the Comédie Française or, you know, a missile or any of the other subjects I'd done, the experience is similar to that of City Hall. You know, I have an idea. I'm willing to roll the dice that if I hang around long enough, I'll collect enough material out of which I can edit a film. I take that risk, and so far I've been lucky enough that I've been able to make a film from that gamble.
Coming up, a wail of dissent from the second branch of city government, which was left out of the picture. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. It's a funny thing when Fred Wiseman does your town, we're looking at a place we thought we knew. So many things we learn here, Fred. One thing, I've never laughed so much in a Fred Wiseman movie as in this one.
I think there are others that are pretty funny too, actually.
No, but this one, I mean, the rat patrol in the apartment, the marriage at City Hall, I, Becca, take thee, Molly, and the clerk doesn't know quite what to make of it.
By the authority vested in me by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, I now pronounce you married. Here we go. Stand together, okay? Mm-hmm. All right, smile.
Fighting parking tickets, even when people know they're guilty.
I'm not averse to a little comedy.
It's tough for me to prove the ticket was given incorrectly, but I didn't. When I parked the car, there wasn't any sign for resident permit parking there. It was just a meter, I thought, and I just didn't see a sign. And I figure 9 o'clock, I'm fine, and I come out and get a ticket at 10. I mean, I can't understand what happened. So, I just don't know.
The rat patrol scene goes very, very sad as we watch, but even that has a deep humor about it, I think.
There are aspects that are funny, but it's sad comedy.
Yeah.
A lot of good comedy is sad.
Yes.
Heavy activity down here.
I know it wasn't imaginative.
No.
I never seen rats before here.
Yeah, you're getting a lot.
Before this, I had raccoons in my ceiling, and they
They
dug two holes, and I patched that one up. But with the heavy rain, he dug a big circle in the wood.
Yeah.
And the water was coming in, and the rain, the sheetrock just came down. My two brothers own a part of this, and one of my brothers is trying to evict me because I think he wants to come down to my apartment, which is better than his.
Gotcha. Okay.
For me, the most wonderful scene was with those sketchy businessmen planning a cannabis shop in the poorest part of Roxbury. And to my delight and amazement, the people knew exactly what was going on.
At the end of the day, this is a common intersection for everyone. Those imaginary lines doesn't exist because we have to go to Walgreens to get our medications. We have to go get Pampers and our daily stuff that we need right away. We need Walgreens in our community. We don't necessarily need a smoke shop.
To the point where the woman said, wait a second, are we going to get to vote on this? No. Do we want it? No. Can we stop it? Probably not.
I included that sequence in the movie for just the reasons you said, because you got, at least I felt when watching that sequence, and originally it was probably close to 2 hours, and it's about 26 minutes in the film.
Wow.
You get a sense of the various community groups who take an interest in the life of their community, and you get a sense of the nitty-gritty problems of opening up a cannabis store in the neighborhood, problems of parking, crime, employment, business opportunities, Asian businessmen coming into a predominantly Black and, to some extent, Hispanic community. So that there are all kinds of really complex questions that were being discussed around the issue of opening up a cannabis store.
I'm just concerned that are we going to make this a multicultural employment area? Because, like I said, a lot of the times, the Asians that do come in our community, they don't hire me.
We have to hire locally because that's the easiest community outreach we can do. And also for the operation sense, it's the best way to do it.
You were listening carefully for local rivalries. I mean, the guy who says those Savin Hill people don't have much use for the people on the other side of Dorchester Avenue.
And some of those people that you're talking to are making decisions for the rest of us in this room that don't consider us. Like some of the people over in Savin Hill that don't like this side of Dorchester, okay? Don't really give a crap about us. And it's all about their agenda that they have set forth. So that's one thing.
It was very clear-headed. It was very sound. It was certainly not troublemaking, but let's be real. There are people here in Muslim dress. There are people of Black skin, lighter skin, white skin, you call it, but they vented very openly what their real interests were.
This community meeting is part of the process for you to get your license?
Mm-hmm.
And then does this community meeting have a process to vote?
No.
So does this community... So after we talk and we vent and we cry laugh...
Exactly what it is. It's a quiet...
What happens?
Nothing.
I'll answer that for you. Nothing. As I did earlier. We take what happens here back to City Hall.
Uh-huh.
Okay. We have a conversation here about what happened there. You're also allowed
to... City Hall meaning the mayor or...
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Go back and we iterate what happened here.
We need to get organized and get to the city then.
Yes.
We need to change this process.
Yes.
Representative, if you...
The city is an endless series of meetings. Again, I was just impressed that people spoke up. There was a developer there telling of all the good things he was going to do. He was going to give the NAACP free rent for 7 years or something like that. And the woman said... A Black woman, striking woman, says forcefully about the input from developers. She says, community benefits should be driven by the community.
And not by a developer. Community benefits shouldn't just be a shot in the arm. It should be long term. It should be, build equity in the community. So that's my concern. And my concern is that the voice that carries that piece around community benefit resonate and come from the community.
That was a very moving statement.
Amen.
Yes, amen. But implicit in her comment, how is the community voice to be registered? Is it to be registered by the people that show up at the meetings? Is it to be registered by the number of community organizations that are represented? Will there be a vote? I mean, the whole issue of who speaks for the community is a question that is raised in a number of the meetings in the film.
Absolutely. It's deep. Maybe in that same meeting, somebody said, well, you know, what they call civic associations, the formal meetings, the neighborhood groups, they tend to be white. And that's not us.
Right. That's a good example of what I'm talking about.
Right.
I mean, even in the cannabis meeting, which you're referring to, where there are clearly a lot of groups represented, all a city can do in that kind of situation is have a number of meetings and have as many people who want to come, it's not perfect. I mean, I don't know what would be perfect. It's a lot better than what used to exist.
It's a lot better than the way Congress works.
Oh, that's for sure. Because there was give and take. You had the feeling that everybody in that room was ready to negotiate. Mitch McConnell was not there.
And they were very clear-headed about their own interest and very articulate about presenting it. I mean, it's a moment when everybody worries, can democracy survive, et cetera. What is democracy? And more than anything, you come away from that movie thinking, that's democracy. Put people in a room and keep talking. They're civil. They're clear. They're kind of heroic. The thought is out there. Rahm Emanuel was pushing it as mayor of Chicago that, in fact, the mayors run the world. And that mayors may be the real legislators. I think Marty Walsh feels that, and I think you were encouraging him.
A city hall, a city government, touches directly more aspects of our lives than any other form of government.
Yeah.
Birth, death, marriage, police, fire, public health, building construction, building inspection, emergency care, on and on and on. And I can't speak for other people, but I know that it's the kind of thing that I always took for granted without really thinking about how it was done or the people who worked at it on a daily basis. And I came away both moved and impressed by the dedication of the people I saw at work at City Hall.
There's a wonderful scene. You have to see the picture in a way, but it's a kind of forest of 2x4s in a rehab site where a city inspector is checking on the work of an Irish immigrant carpenter. It's beautiful visually, all that raw wood with a view of the ocean. And the guy is saying, you've got a great view out there until somebody fills that lot across the street. But they laugh. Right. They know what they're doing.
Exactly. They know what they're doing. They're competent. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So all this fire caulking is done, all the penetrations.
Yep.
Okay. What are you doing for railings here?
The railings are all on the second floor. It's
iron?
It's iron railings, yeah, the wire.
Okay.
So.
All right. It's not a bad view, huh?
No, it's a bit more.
There's still a paradox here, Fred. Something's clearly working here, and yet a lot of the people who live in Boston would tell you it's sitting on a contradiction. It's such a wonderful place to live, even apart from the sports teams and the weather, but the people who work here can't afford to live here. Did you see any way out of that?
What I tried to do is underline or present some of these issues without in any way trying to resolve them. I'm not experienced enough in any one of them to offer an economic analysis or a plan to make things better. What I can do and what I tried to do in the movie is to show that there are people working in city government who have a vast knowledge of these issues and are busting their asses to trying to help other people.
Yeah.
Whether it's in housing or neighborhood redevelopment or aiding small business or encouraging people to participate in politics. I mean, there's such a wide variety of activities that you see administered through City Hall. But one of the themes that cuts through it all, and I think this is Marty Walsh's doing, is he's saying to everybody, get out, participate, work.
I wondered, Fred, how much of the story there is very, very old. As I watched the movie, I thought, you know, the most famous Bostonians wouldn't recognize this city. James Michael Curley, mayor four times, or John Kennedy, who began his career here, or Tip O'Neill, people of that era. It's utterly unrecognizable. And yet, the engagement of younger immigrant stock and becoming middle class and entirely American is an old story.
Yeah, that's right. What's the American story? I mean, to use the cliche, but it is the American story. And it's a story that Trump is trying to get people to forget or not take into account. Trump's absence in the movie, except for a couple of references, underlines the significance and importance of what Mayor Walsh and his staff are trying to do. I mean, if this movie had been released when Obama was president, well, I think the reaction would have been, well, Marty Walsh is a very good mayor and he's trying to do a very good job and he's succeeding. But the reaction to it wouldn't have been as extreme as it is because the contrast is so much greater because of Trump's idiocies.
Yeah. Fascinating. By the end of this movie, you've seen 100 people say in a meeting talking about some public issue, whether it's garbage collection or planning or what are we going to do about opioids or what about Long Island coming back as a halfway place. They're all doing it with good hearts, reasonable goodwill, for nothing, and they're finding some sort of fulfillment. It's a dreamy vision of the way public life could be and is.
It's not dreamy in the sense that, at least to me, dreamy implies that nothing gets done. You're sitting out looking out the window and having a fantasy, but that's not true. I mean, there's been a lot. I mean, I don't know the numbers, but I know that, I mean, I have this vague recollection that somebody says in the film that 25,000 units of affordable housing have been built during Mayor Walsh's tenure. I don't know if that's an accurate figure or not, but certainly a lot of affordable housing has been built. There's been a lot of development in downtown Boston.
$9 billion.
$9 billion. There's been an enormous effort to get more work for more contracts for minority businesses.
What is not so dreamy about Fred Wiseman's movie is getting left out of it. Lydia Edwards is one of 13 members of the Boston City Council, the legislative branch in City Hall, that Fred Wiseman missed entirely. What's worse, that Rainbow Council elected last year, multiracial and almost half female, is young and engaged. One of their stars, Ayanna Pressley, made the leap to Congress in 2018 against a Democratic incumbent who had full support of the Marty Walsh machine. So who's got the city's pulse? Lydia Edwards has a grievance to air.
To talk about City Hall and not include or focus or think or ask about any member of City Council, the most diverse City Council, the most representative City Council, the historic City Council, really rubs me in a different way, because I really didn't wonder what's the point of the film. Is it to really be a puff piece for Marty and his administration? Or is it to actually demonstrate what City Hall looks like?
Mm-hmm.
We are also duly elected by our communities to represent and provide a voice and perspective. And many of the hearings, many of the conversations were driven by us. I think there was a cannabis community meeting. The legislation for it was written by Councillor Janey, a Black woman from Roxbury.
Mm-hmm.
Bruce Bowling, representing that neighborhood as a city council president, completely excluded from this film. So look, I mean, if Marty got a spotlight, he's a politician, he better dance in it. And that's what he got, 4.5 hours of it. But if you really look at the premise, whether this is or isn't how city government works, what the reality is, why weren't any of the counselors part of this? Especially this one. I mean, the most women ever, the most people of color ever. We actually, unlike his administration, represent the city of Boston demographically.
Mm-hmm.
And to not include that entire body.
The cannabis hearing was so interesting. I didn't know the background of the history of having a public meeting on that subject, but it's a terrific little vignette of the people's business out in the neighborhood being discussed and talked about intelligently and critically. Like, are we going to vote on this? What are we here for? We don't like your idea. And they said it rather politely, but firmly and clearly. I thought it was a wonderful show of common sense people acting together. But had you heard about that scene?
I had heard about that scene. And I remember rolling my eyes about that scene because the administration had so badly messed up that scene and conversation in my neighborhood that it resulted in reform legislation from the city council to push for better process, having to push the administration to set up the cannabis board, which they sat on and did nothing with until we demanded that of them, to push for this local government to be the best it can be. Do I believe that there are everyday people working hard? Absolutely. But I believe that that's with or without Trump in office. I think it's a very narrow perspective, a naive one, and one based on trying to make the mayor hero in a moment where it's not heroic to just do your job. It's not groundbreaking to do your job.
How does the council feel about the general tone, tenor, direction of City Hall these days? the Fred Wiseman picture is that if you hang around and look carefully at a variety of meetings with the mayor and without, there's a kind of very classic neighborly civility, forthrightness, awareness, courage to speak up.
So here's the thing. Any of the latest conversations or the conversations during the hearings that we've had with the administration as a council in the last 6 months, you will see tension, disappointment, anger, accusations of being lack of responsive to people of color, to poor people, to not actually doing the job that they are supposed to be doing in terms of cannabis, in terms of equity, in terms of planning, in terms of development. I mean, to exclude the other half of the community meetings with the BPDA where people are in opposition and screaming at government, to exclude the meetings where things fall apart. And there are many of those. So no, I don't think you can honestly get that perspective if you are truly trying to demonstrate how city government is working or not. There are many workers as individuals who just do an incredible job, sure. And there's two different aspects of City Hall. There's those who just rank and file work, and then those who are part of the close-knit power structure with the mayor. They have to play politics. Their job is depending on their political allegiance to him. And that is not a bad thing. That's the reality that you are living in.
Lydia Edwards is the Boston City Councilor for District 1, the mixed ethnic neighborhoods of Charlestown, the North End, and East Boston. Coming up, City Hall itself, the building that listens and talks. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Boston City Hall, the building itself, has very nearly a speaking part in Fred Wiseman's movie. Made of brick and concrete, an echoing vastness inside, it has been loved and ridiculed for half a century now. The Aztec ruin, or maybe a fortified Disney castle, it was designed in the 1960s and celebrated here and there as a model space for civic engagement. The style, using man-made stone, was called Brutalist, and it caught on. It was later renamed the Heroic Style, which the original architects loved. Yesterday's brute was today's hero. We've talked before with architects in that space about what the building is saying.
Of course, the signature is concrete. The label became Brutal. I wish you'd just go back to the beginning of the vision that, wait a sec, something significant converged here in that moment, and then begin to outline the argument. Not only brutal, heroic, but is it really a good building in the end? Why has it been so controversial? It is so beautiful to be in it. At the same time, it's a warlike building. It's a Cold War building. Pat Moynihan said to me once, just very casually, we were talking in Washington before he became senator, but he said, I think of that City Hall and I think of, you know, the defenders of the realm pouring boiling oil on the outraged populace down below. I also remember Kevin White, who was important to me, introduced me to my wife, but a neighbor and friend for many, many years, and we didn't appreciate really how good he was at his job. He loved the complexity, the mystery of this building, and particularly his own office, which is the really the great view. But he said they could find Hitler in Berchtesgaden faster than they could find me in City Hall. that sense of we're inside the fortress. And anyway, pick up the thread of what drove you to make a statement around this building. Michael.
One of the real reasons that we were interested in picking up exactly that thread and telling its story was not just that these were buildings that for us were symbolic of a real set of social and cultural ideals. I mean, this was, as you say, it was the new frontier under Kennedy through to the Great Society under Lyndon Johnson. And there was a faith in the civic realm and in the expression of that faith.
Can you imagine naming a place a government center in this day and age? I mean,
yeah, today it would be commercial development or developer-driven. It would be a whole other set of things, but it would not primarily that level of investment for a civic center that would have both federal and state and city government all kind of encapsulated in one set of services would be, to my mind, almost unthinkable.
In a way, if you had a museum of concrete architecture, Boston would be the finest in the country at the very least.
You know, there's this beautiful cliche that architecture is frozen music. We've all heard that. Reading your book and thinking about this, I thought, no, architecture is frozen politics, really.
Totally.
It's not only from LBJ to Nixon to Reagan to the present, but it's also a tremendous loss of, let's be real, effervescence from Kevin White, but especially John Collins.
It's also worth noting that, you know, Collins moved his desk in before the building was fully open so that he could say that he was the first occupant of the building.
Right.
Right?
I think he ended up getting pneumonia as well out of the experience. The heat wasn't even on at that point.
It's not the
building's cold now.
I want you to answer, though, the rude question about why the building has always been problematic. Tominino wanted to move the city government out. Marty Walsh, as a candidate, wanted to blow it up. People have been wary. I have my own theory, but I want to hear yours as to why it hasn't been properly maintained, why it hasn't been embraced. I mentioned the sort of the fortress feeling of it.
The building's politically expedient with regards to media. I think Mayor Walsh probably used that to get back in a news cycle, because I think what he's done with the building since then has pointed in a different direction. But I think, you know, Mayor Menino had a campaign of active neglect of the building.
In some respects, I think, and it's not just this building, but all of these buildings of this time period, many of them, because they're civic, are suffering from the fact that we don't fund our civic realm in the same way that we did when they were built. So, you know, the fact that there are lights out is partly because it's, you know, we don't have the funding to sort of transform buildings like this. So I think there's a number of layers of problems. The other part of your question of what the public perceives the building as, none of us think that this is all perfect architecture, that, you know, it should be just kept the way it is. I think we see faults in this architecture as well. The building represents a utopian moment in political life, and we are not so open to that anymore.
In terms of the desire to provide a space that would be unlike any other major urban space in Boston, in other words, not green, you know, not like the public gardens or the Boston Common, basically a flat, hardscaped space where people could gather in protest, whatever the content of that protest would be. There is, to my mind, a history of success in terms of the intention, although, you know, politics in Boston can often be, let's say, unpleasant.
Thanks to the architects Mark Pasnik, Michael Kubo, and Chris Grimley. They wrote the book on the heroic style in Boston.
You have anything in your buckets, ma'am?
Fred, as I watched, I thought, Fred Wiseman loves architecture and Boston buildings the way Woody Allen did in the movie Manhattan. I love those long cutaways of old, new, big houses, skyscrapers. You shot them so beautifully.
Well, I wanted to give a sense of the city and the architecture of the city. I mean, they serve a variety of purposes. One is to give a sense of the architecture and the variety and types and sorts of buildings. But I also needed them as transitions from one part of the city to another. So when I went from downtown to Roxbury,
right,
I could use some shots of downtown and then some shots of streets in Roxbury before we, well, lighted, so to speak, in a church in Roxbury. But I had the choice of shooting people on the street or shooting the buildings. And in some films, for instance, in Model, you see a lot of people on the street in New York City and in the various neighborhoods of New York, but you don't get a sense of the architecture. Here, I wanted to get a sense of the architecture.
Incredibly varied, Victorian, modern, brick being the essential building material.
Right.
What are your favorite scenes that we haven't mentioned?
It's very strange. I like them all.
I liked somebody shouting, Springboard, that should be the name of our recovery program.
I mean, there are a lot of young people in that meeting where they're discussing Long Island.
And opioids.
Oh, and opioids.
Springboard, not even the
springboard.
There's no expectation of recovery. Like, it's not like most other services. You don't go there because you're ready necessarily. You can go there and just to get your snack. But then over enough time, maybe that will be the thing that that springs you forward.
An incredibly interesting mediation space for some, a social space for other, a living room, a pit stop. Also thinking about, you know, how do we tell the story about what's happening here? What's the story that Boston's trying to tell around recovery, being such an epicenter, I think, regionally? And so I think there's some interesting connections to think about. You know, how do we talk about this? How do we talk about Long Island?
Well, obviously, there's a political side to all of this, too, because this exists in a neighborhood. So this is the corner of Melnia, Cass, and Mass Ave. People call it Methadone Mile. We call it Recovery Road.
They're very enthusiastic, and they're very, very sincere.
Yep.
And they're extremely dedicated. And I don't know enough about their activities over a period of time, but I have the impression that they will accomplish something. Hmm. How much, I don't know, because I'm not familiar with all of the work that they do. But they care, and they're intelligent in terms of individual participation. That's as much as you can ask for.
The concept of resilience is a powerful one. It resonates with every aspect of city life and planning in our city and what we do in our city every day. And our decision to focus on our racial equity work was important to our city to move on. And to move forward, really. Not move on, move forward.
Resilience, recovery is Marty Walsh's label on the whole enterprise, including the city. Is that the theme of the movie in the end?
Well, I think the theme of the movie is the importance of government. He has a real understanding of the neighborhoods and the issues that are prominent in the neighborhoods and their relationship to federal and state issues. It wasn't it, you know, sometimes people say to me, well, all politicians are actors. But I felt that he was, you know, he was quite genuine. I mean, he probably makes four or five appearances a day, and he's an accomplished public speaker.
We have great prosperity in the city of Boston right now, and one out of every six Bostonians is struggling with food insecurity. That's the message today. That's something that we need to work together to tackle this issue to get that number to zero. No one should have to worry about where the next meal is coming from. Everyone deserves access to food, and that's everyone's basic human right. In Boston, we need to know that work fighting hunger is important, and the impact that we're doing in fighting has to go much further.
I mean, every sequence in the movie is an illustration in one way or another of the need for government, for competent civil government. For example, there's a sequence in the movie on Veterans Day in Faneuil Hall.
Yes.
Where veterans of the Second World War, the Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Afghanistan War, the war in Iraq, are all talking about their experiences. And the fact that it takes place in Faneuil Hall has resonance for American history. Because, you know, it was there that many of the founders of the country met to discuss and work on the Declaration of Independence.
It was almost like we were a pawn in somebody's chess game. And I had the opportunity to call home. And I called my mother, and the first thing I said to her was, Ma, I said, Ma, I want to just apologize to you for all the problems I caused you when I was in high school. And she said, why are you talking to me like this? And I said, because you'll probably never see me again. And she said, what do you mean? I said, everybody in my unit's dying. I said, we're the most northern outpost the Marines have. We're surrounded. They're bombarding us every day. I said, sometimes they don't even bring us water. We have to drink mud and eat grass. And my mother said, you're not going to die. I said, Ma, I'm trying to tell you something. She said, I talk to God every day, and you're special. You're coming back. And I said, Ma, everybody's mother thinks they're special. Okay, I'm putting pieces of special people in bags. Listen to what I'm saying. Don't believe what you read in the Globe or what you see on the 6 o'clock news. We're losing the war. We're being sacrificed. You're probably not going to see me again. And she kept saying, you're coming back. She tried to tell a joke. She said, besides, if you don't come back, she said, you got to come back. I said, what do you mean I got to come back? She said, if you don't come back, who's going to pay this telephone bill?
One of the reasons that I spent so much time with the veterans and they're telling the stories of their war experiences is because war is the absence of government. It's the absence of a civil way, an agreed on way, a democratic way of resolving disputes. So for me, the real theme of the movie is the way Mayor Walsh deals with the need of people to have a functioning civil government, the need for a civil society.
The Faneuil Hall scene is also the wonderful moment when Andrew Biggio comes to the fore, ex-Marine from Iraq and Afghanistan, and says, I grew up in Andrew Biggio Square. And then the story of how he rediscovered his uncle, or forefather, and made an unbelievable connection.
Yeah.
That square was not named after me. It was named after my uncle, who was killed in action in World War II. the first Andrew Biggio. It wasn't until I was getting ready to go to my first tour in Iraq that I was looking at that street sign saying Andrew Biggio Square, and it was a weird feeling knowing that I'm the next Andrew Biggio to go to war, and the first Andrew Biggio went to war and didn't come back. So I survived Iraq, I survived a tour in Afghanistan, and I came home and I was staring at that street sign again, and I said, I gotta find out what happened to that first Andrew Biggio on that hill in Italy in 1944.
And he also talks about his neighbor, who was always a big grouch. And then the neighbor is so proud of Andrew becoming a Marine, he gives him his most treasured possession, which is some gold teeth that must have been plucked out from the mouth of a Japanese soldier in Okinawa, which is superficially funny. It's another illustration of the savagery of war.
Right. I marvel at just the handiwork, the mind, the eye of Fred Wiseman, surfacing these incredibly important feelings with pictures.
I'll let the management or the landlord know what's going on as far as the issue.
Right.
What I'll do is I'll try to talk to them.
Right.
Find out what's going on.
Right. Yeah.
And where the disconnect happened. So hopefully we can come to some sort of resolution.
Yeah.
Where you're not living in, you know, with a pest infestation.
I know.
In the leaks.
Because they spread disease too.
All right.
You know. All right. And, you know, I try to keep it clean as I can here, but I'm a bachelor right now and living here for 18 years since I got divorced.
Gotcha.
Yeah, and, you know, I've made my mistakes, but, you know, I don't do drugs or anything.
Right.
You know, I'm clean. And
nope, that's good.
I have a glass of wine here and there, and even lately I lost my, my spirit's broken.
Mm-hmm. No.
You know, because they want to throw me to the street after all, you know.
Right.
You know.
Right. No, I can imagine.
I know, so.
Anyone's so spirit I, you know, would be broken.
I've been going through mental health with the VA.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I got some anxiety pills and, I'm on, blood pressure pills and, baby aspirin because I get stents in me for my heart.
Right.
But I'm still alive.
Yeah.
Hopefully move on to something better soon.
Yeah.
You know?
No, and, we'll try to,
I'm almost 71.
We'll try to help you out as much as possible.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
And I'll talk to them to see what exactly is going on.
Okay.
All right.
Sounds good. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Anytime.
It's kind of emotional minimalism, but it can knock you down.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that because, I work very hard in trying to tell the story with both the picture and the sound. One of the things I've learned over the years, or at least I hope I've learned over the years, is how to think in visual terms. The film is an illustration of what can happen when people are committed to working together and resolving their conflicts. It's something that's absent at a federal level. And one can only hope it will come back.
Yeah. I got to say, I've lived here almost all my life, ran for mayor myself once, but it's completely changed and very much the same process of goodwill bargaining, negotiating, thinking of other people's kids, what they're going to inherit, what we're going to do together. It's all there. Marty Walsh says at the end, one city can be an example, and he may just be right.
I think he is right. At least there's an example. I'm not familiar with other mayors, but as good as Marty Walsh is, I'm sure there are other mayors in America who are good. I mean, all politicians aren't like Trump, thank God. I'm sure that Rahm Emanuel was a very good mayor of Chicago, and the woman that succeeded him, I'm sure, is a very good mayor. And I'm sure there are plenty of other cities that have good mayors. It's such a vast country and such a complicated country, and we've been allowed ourselves to be so overwhelmed by Trump that we forget that there are decent politicians who are trying to do a good job and that they actually exist.
There are decent politicians who want to run against Marty Walsh and beat him. Two women that I can think of offhand. There's a lot of future here. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, thank you, Chris. I appreciate you doing it.
Fred Wiseman's new film is called City Hall. Look for it in theaters till Thanksgiving and then on PBS next month. Check our website for our last program with Fred Wiseman from 2018, all about his Red State film, Monrovia, Indiana, and Fred's long lifetime of looking and listening
One of the things that interests me is how people live very self-contained lives, that they're not curious about what's going on 15 miles away.
Search for it at Radio Open Source, where there's loads more conversation. And while you're up, consider leaving a tip for the hardest working team in radio. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Mary McGrath. Max Liebman engineered. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time for Open Source.